Hello,
and welcome to the world of the unknown, the world of the frightening and the strange, a world where Daniel and I live. Welcome to Conspiracy 101.
Yes.
And we're going to talk about some strange stuff.
Very strange.
But first, let's talk about the strange co-host, Daniel Lucas. Hi, Daniel.
Certainly. Yes. Strangest thing of all.
Yeah. So,
very
Daniel, what do you think about tonight?
Yes. What are we going to talk about?
What would be a good one to have tonight?
Yes. If you're strange, you said it's strange. Let's talk about UFO, because I think it's the news today that everybody talks about.
Oh, it was in the news today, really? Okay. Well, unfortunately,
yes.
I don't have a UFO story for you. But I do have something that's strange right here. Talking about the big guy. And Daniel, live in the heart of Bigfoot country.
Oh, yes. Bigfoot.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Pacific
Mr.
Northwest, you were in the Vancouver way there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where a lot of Bigfoot sightings are.
Oh, my. Really?
Yeah. Follow Bigfoot at all?
No. No,
not
at all.
It only ranks as a conspiracy because there's a lot of people that don't believe it's real. And there are people who believe that Bigfoot is real. And then there's people who believe that Bigfoot is a giant, like, relic hominid ape type thing. And there are people who think it's an alien.
Oh, my.
Before we get started, where do you think you're at on that?
Bigfoot.
Is it not real? Is it real? Is it an ape or an alien?
I think it's a big version of an ape.
A big ape. Okay.
Yes.
That's kind of where I'm at for the most part, too. The alien part I'm not so sure about yet, but we'll see. Maybe I'm wrong. It may all happen soon. We may find out, so. But let me get
Let's
into it,
out.
Shall we? Shall we get
yes.
into this?
Yes, you may. Let's
so,
do this.
So, as you can see, we have an outline of Bigfoot, taller than the trees here, because he's big, obviously. All right, so take a moment and think about a shadowy forest, right? And silhouettes, like the one that we have here on the title. But you might want to think about a massive bipedal figure standing perfectly still between those second and third trees on the left.
Oh, okay.
I can tell you by the end of this, you will, and you will not be able to unsee it. That's the promise.
That's the promise.
Here's the thing about Bigfoot that most people miss. The question is not whether you believe
or not.
The question is whether the evidence compels you to stop not believing. And that, my friends, is a very different cognitive position. So settle in. The forest is dark. The evidence is mounting. And something very large is walking towards us out of that tree line.
Interesting.
Before Bigfoot became a pop culture phenomenon, before the bumper stickers, before the beef jerky commercials, before Uncle Gary's cabin decor, indigenous peoples across North America had already been documenting encounters with enormous hairy bipedal creatures for centuries, millennia in some cases, and they did not seem particularly amused by it. What you're looking at
Why
on the
not?
Slide here are cave paintings and carvings depicting figures that are, to put it scientifically, really quite large. The Stelios people of British Columbia, hey, that's where you're at, have the Saquettes.
Saquettes.
The Lakota have the Chiatanka. The Iroquois have the Otneru.
Okay.
Dozens of distinct indigenous nations separated by vast distances and entirely different cultural traditions all landed on roughly the same description. Tall, covered in hair, walks on two legs, smells terrible, and does not appreciate anybody else's company. That is either the most remarkable coincidence in anthropology history, or these people were describing something they actually saw. Now, look at the map. You see those glowing pens lighting up across North America?
Yes.
Are not clustered around one gullible town in rural Georgia. They span the continent from the swamps of Florida to the forests of the Pacific Northwest, from the Appalachians to the Rockies, 60,000 square miles of suitable habitat in the Pacific Northwest alone. To put that in perspective, that is larger than the entire country of Georgia, you know, over in Russia. The nation, not the state. Although, frankly, both Georgias kind of share some unexplained phenomenon. The ancients were not conspiracy theorists. They were observers. They lived in their forest. They knew every animal in the territory by sound, by track, or by scat, and they still reported something they could not explain. I think we owe a little respect to them and not dismiss it entirely. So this is a picture from the most famous Bigfoot film. October 20th, 1967, Roger Patterson and Bob Gimlin ride on horseback through Bluff Creek in Northern California. I've actually been there, Daniel. Did I tell you that?
Oh, my.
A rented 16-millimeter camera and what turns out to be absolutely historic quantity of luck. Okay. The horses spook. Something large moves along the creek bed. Patterson, to his eternal credit, falls off his horse, scrambles to his feet, grabs the camera, and runs towards the thing. So think about that. He ran toward it. He didn't run away. So whatever survival instinct most people possess, Roger Patterson had clearly swapped it out for something entirely different. What resulted is 59 seconds of footage that has divided scientists, film analysts, costume designers, primatologists, and people who take themselves very seriously at dinner parties for nearly 60 years. The figure, large, dark-haired, bipedal, walks away from the camera, pauses, turns, that's what we're seeing here, to look directly at Patterson and then continues walking into the tree line. That look over the shoulder, that single glance, it is the most debated moment in cryptozoological history, and it will be the subject of our next two slides because it absolutely deserves attention.
Definitely.
Now, we may be watching this flickery golden film reel recreation and thinking, that looks like a person in a suit, and that is a fair instinct. It is the correct instinct to have. The problem, and this is where things get interesting, is that the more you examine the footage with modern tools, the harder the suit hypothesis becomes to defend. The musculature moves differently. The proportions are wrong for a human. The gait is biomechanically peculiar in ways that are very difficult to fake. Very difficult, not impossible, but very, very difficult. Film yourself walking in a gorilla suit and report back. So let's talk about the walk.
Yes.
That walk, if Patterson-Gimlin footage gives you nothing else, if you dismiss every footprint, every hair sample, every trembling eyewitness who swears on their mother's grandmother's grave, the walk alone demands your attention. And these golden measurements overlaid on the screen are not decorations. They are doing work. Here's what biomechanics experts have noted about the figure's gait when studied at normal and slowed playback speeds. The knee flexion during the stride cycle is inconsistent with normal human walking. Humans straighten their knees at the top of each stride. This figure does not. It maintains a bent knee posture throughout the entire walking sequence in a way that would require extraordinary muscular endurance for a human to sustain, even briefly, without visible strain. Professional athletes and stunt performers who have attempted to replicate this gait consistently report significant quad fatigue within a minute and a complete inability to maintain the upper body fluidity shown in the footage simultaneously. Then there's the arm swing. The arms are proportionally longer than human arms and swing in a manner consistent with a heavier, wide-shouldered upper body distributing its mass differential than a Homo sapiens would. You can see this in the golden overlays that it is not a person walking normally. This is not a person walking strangely. This is somebody walking exactly as it was evolved to walk, which is the most unsettling possibility of all. The question mark pulses on the screen is earned It is not there for dramatic effect. Well, partially for dramatic effect, I guess. But there's also because nobody, not the believers, not the skeptics, have fully and satisfactorily answered what exactly is doing that walk in those 59 seconds of film. Nobody in 57 years. And that's why that's a question mark, because nobody's figured it all out.
Mm-hmm.
Plaster casts, the love language of cryptozoology. The evidence format that says, I cannot bring you the creature, but I can bring you the exact dimensions of its foot, set in gypsum under the velvet spotlight at a conference. And look at what we have on the slide. Look at these collections. Each one enormous, each one suspiciously, almost offensively large. The largest among them would correspond to a creature somewhere between 7 and 9 feet tall and weighing several hundred pounds, and they are everywhere. Over the decades, researchers and accidental witnesses have collected hundreds of casts from locations across North America. The footprints that produce them show consistent anatomical features. A double ball structure on the midfoot, consistent with a flexible, non-rigid foot, unlike any known ape. Dermal ridges analogous to human fingerprints, but arranged differently. And in several cases, toe spread patterns indicating an animal pushing off with its full body weight. Forensic examiner Jimmy Chilcutt, a fingerprint specialist with law enforcement experience, examined several casts in the late 1990s and concluded that the dermal ridge patterns were not human and not consistent with any known primate. He went in a skeptic, but did he come out as one? Now, could one of these be faked? Of course they can. Ray Wallace, a Washington road builder, had wooden big feet made and stomped around in them for years. He admitted this before he died. Some of these casts are Ray Wallace's artistic legacy and nothing more. But here is the critical point. The fakes are identifiable as fakes on close inspection, which means the ones that are not identifiable as fakes are still in the pile, still glowing under the spotlight, still suspiciously large, still waiting. Let's talk numbers for a moment. Because this scroll is not decorating the slide, it is doing something important. The Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, which is a real organization staffed by people with real jobs and real lives who would very much like you to take them seriously, have cataloged over 5,000 reported sightings since it began tracking them formally. That's 5,000. That's not a small sample. That's a data set. And these are only the reported ones. Researchers estimate that actual number of encounters is much higher because the primary reaction most people have after seeing something enormous in the woods is not to call a research organization. It's to drive away very quickly and tell nobody.
Nobody.
Nobody. Look at those pins lighting up the map. Every state in the continental United States has sightings on record. Every single one. Florida, Texas, Ohio, New Jersey. Which frankly explains a lot of things about New Jersey, because it's weird New Jersey, you know. The clustering is heaviest in the Pacific Northwest and the Appalachian Corridor, which makes ecological sense if you're the kind of person who thinks ecologically about a cryptid, and I am absolutely that kind of person. The witnesses' profiles are also worth noting. These are not exclusively people who read a lot of Bigfoot books and went looking. They are hunters who have spent decades in the woods and know perfectly well what a bear looks like from behind. They're forestry workers. They're truck drivers passing through mountain corridors at 3 a.m. who had no agenda whatsoever and would frankly prefer that this hadn't even happened. The sheer demographic diversity of the witnesses is one of the more compelling aspects of the cumulative case. Credulous people believe things. But credulous people, skeptical people, and people who have never been given a Bigfoot a single thought in their lives are all reporting the same thing across 60 years requires a more nuanced explanation than mass gullibility. I got to take a drink here, Daniel.
Well, Mr. Bob, take your time.
Science is supposed to have the answers. That is the whole deal with science. You bring in a sample, it runs its test, it tells you what the thing is, everyone goes home informed. Hair samples from various Bigfoot encounter sites have been submitted to laboratories on multiple occasions, and science has responded with what can only be described as a very expensive shrug. What we know, the hair on this slide is real hair. It's not synthetic. It is not plant. It has a medullary structure consistent with primate hair. And in a significant number of cases, the mitochondrial DNA analysis has come back with results that cannot be confidently matched to any known North American animal, not a bear, not a human, not a great ape. The helix on screen is still not refusing to match anything out of stubbornness. It is refusing because the match is not in the database. Now, the sensible explanation that skeptics will immediately offer is contamination. Lab contamination is real, sample contamination in the field is real, and absolutely accounts for some of the most inconclusive results. The scientists in the background of this slide who are exchanging nervous glances are probably also thinking about contamination. But contamination cannot explain every anomalous result from every independent lab across multiple decades. At some point, the contamination hypothesis starts requiring as much faith as the Bigfoot hypothesis. And that is when things get philosophically interesting. Dr. Melba Ketchum published a 2013 study claiming that Bigfoot DNA represents a novel hominid hybrid. That study was controversial, to put it extremely mildly, and the scientific community treated accordingly. But the underlying question she was asking, was it this hair, has not been cleanly answered. The lab coat crowd knows it too. Those nervous glances are genuine. Thermal imaging changed the game. Or, at least it changed the shape of the argument, which is the next best thing. When you can no longer debate whether someone saw something large shape in bad light, you can have actual heat signature moving through Oregon forest on a monitor. The conversation necessarily evolves. That enormous upright blob of warm color moving between trees is not a glitch. Heat signatures do not glitch. Heat signatures are literal physics. The footage this slide references was captured during an organized research expedition, has been analyzed by people who use thermal cameras professionally for purposes entirely unrelated to cryptozoology. The consensus amongst these analysts is the signature is consistent with a large, warm-blooded animal, upright, bipedal, and substantially heavier than a human based on the heat distribution patterns. Bears, for reference, show up on the thermal in a recognizably bear-shaped way, which is to say horizontal, four-footed, and not particularly interested in walking away from you on two legs with a confident stride. Mm-hmm. These two creatures in camouflage with their mouths open are having the experience that most honest investigators eventually have when they spend enough time in the field, the moment where the data stops being dismissible by reflex and starts requiring actual engagement. Their mouths are open because they expected to film a deer or possibly nothing at all, and what appeared on their monitor was neither of those things. The signature vanishes between a ridge. You know, that's what Bigfoot does. It was a Bigfoot. He has excellent terrain awareness, zero interest in being formally documented. Whatever is out there, bear, unknown primate, large unidentified warm-blooded biped, it went over the ridge and did not look back. Unlike the Patterson-Gimlin figure, who looked back once, just to let you know you saw it. All right, so we got to talk about people who prank Bigfoot sightings, right?
Yes. Who prank?
Who's the pranksters?
Oh, yes.
We owe it to the evidence to acknowledge the pranksters honestly, because the hoaxes are real. They are numerous, and they have done genuine damage to the credibility of the larger case. The rogues gallery on this slide is not presented with affection. These people set the field back decades, and most of them did it for a laugh, which is arguably the least justifiable reason to muddy the scientific waters. Ray Wallace and his carved wooden Bigfoot feet, Tom Biscardi and his frozen rubber Bigfoot in a cooler, and he tried to sell to the media for serious money. The two Georgia men who held a press conference in 2008 with a body in a chest freezer that turned out, upon defrosting, to be a Halloween costume. A Halloween costume in a chest freezer at a press conference, I can't stress enough how much confidence that required. It was the wrong kind of confidence, but it was a tremendous quantity of it. That deflated rubber suit drooping in the corner of this slide is not decoration. It is a monument to human willingness to deceive for personal gain, mild notoriety, or the satisfaction of making other people look foolish. And it is important, because every legitimate researcher in this field knows that the hoaxes are the first thing skeptics reach for, and the only honest response is to agree that, yes, many cases are hoaxes, and then point out that the remaining cases are still there, still unexplained, and still requiring engagement on their own terms. The hoaxes do not disprove Bigfoot. They make proving Bigfoot significantly more annoying. That is a meaningful distinction. The Rogues Gallery knows it too. The confessions scrolling beneath them have a certain sheepishness to them that suggests at least some of these gentlemen have reconsidered their contributions to science. Now we arrive at the part of the presentation where I'm required to acknowledge that what I am about to suggest sounds like the kind of thing someone says at on a podcast at 2 a.m., which you may be listening to this at the podcast at 2 a.m. Those redacted documents floating across your screen are not hypothetical. They are real Forest Service records, real Park Service incident reports, real interagency communications that researchers have obtained through Freedom of Information Act requests. And what is interesting about them is not just what they say, it is what has been removed.
Yeah.
Paragraphs. Entire paragraphs blacked out of what should be routine wildlife encounter documentation. File numbers referencing incidents with no corresponding incident reports in the accessible record. Rangers who reported unusual encounters subsequently reassigned to different posts. None of this individually constitutes proof of anything except bureaucratic impenetrability, which admittedly is an ample supply in the federal agencies and explains many things. But the pattern, taken across multiple agencies over multiple decades, is curious enough to note. That shadowy bureaucratic figure filing the Bigfoot report into a bottomless cabinet is doing something that career archivists would recognize, making information technically accessible while practically irretrievable. The cabinet is bottomless. The filing is meticulous. The document will never be found because the system was not designed to allow it to be found. I'm not telling you the government has a Bigfoot. I'm telling you the government has a filing system, and the filing system has some interesting gaps in it. And those gaps are concentrated in a particular subject area, and the subject area is large, hairy, and bipedal. You can draw your own conclusions.
Mm-hmm.
Giganthopithecus. Say it out loud. It sounds exactly like...
Gigantic.
There you go. It sounds exactly like the kind of thing that would leave a size 22 footprint and frighten a horse in Northern California. Giganthopithecus blackie was a real animal, not hypothetical, not legendary. It was real. We have fossil evidence. It stood between 8 and 10 feet tall. It weighed potentially over 1,000 pounds. It was bipedal or near bipedal. It lived in Asia and thrived for roughly 9 million years before disappearing from the fossil record approximately 300,000 years ago. Disappearing from the fossil record, I should note, is not the same as going extinct. The fossil record is generally quite sparse. The odds of any given animal's remains being preserved, mineralized, and subsequently found by a human with a trowel are extraordinarily low. Colossal squid were considered mythological until fairly recently, and they are enormous animals living in accessible oceans. The forest is not an ocean. Things do not fossilize easily in the forest. Look at the silhouettes on the side, the slide. The Giganthopithecus skeleton reconstruction on the left, the Bigfoot silhouette on the right. I did not ask for you to think of them as identical. I ask you to note that the resemblance is, as the slide text honestly states, uncomfortably convincing. The proportions, the shoulder width, the limb ratios, the cranial structure suggest the skull skull fossils that have been found. If Giganthopithecus crossed the Bering Land Bridge, which other Asia megafauna certainly did, and if a small population survived and retreated into the vast old growth forests of the Pacific Northwest, which are generally vast enough to hide things, then the creature on the right side of the slides might simply be a very successful descendant of the creature on the left.
Mm.
It's not wild speculation. This is a biogeographic hypothesis. Now let's talk about some language. The Sierra sounds.
Yes.
The Patterson-Gimlin footage is the visual centerpiece of Bigfoot evidence. The Sierra sound recordings are the audio equivalent. And in some ways, they are harder to dismiss because audio analysis is less susceptible to costume objections. Nobody has yet proposed a suit that produces vocalizations, Ron Moorhead and Al Berry recorded these sounds in the Sierra Nevada mountains in California during the early 1970s across multiple expeditions, and what is on those recordings has troubled acoustic experts for nearly 50 years. The waveform you see pulsing on screen is not a bear. Acoustic analysis of bear vocalization is well documented, and the bears do not produce sounds with the formant frequencies present in the Sierra sounds. The sounds include what appear to be calls, responses, possible proto-language structures with consistent repeated phenome groupings, and at least one sequence that a university linguist described as showing more structural complexity than anything produced by known non-human primate. That observation was made reluctantly. You could hear the reluctance in the way he phrased it. Scientists do not enjoy saying things like that. The people backing away from their headphones in the background of this slide are having an appropriate reaction. The sounds are unsettling in a specific way, the way something is unsettling when it is almost familiar but not quite, almost language, almost animal, not quite either. The distance between the sound and something you could identify is exactly wide enough to be disturbing and exactly narrow enough to suggest something communicating. Ron Moorhead maintains these recordings to this day. He has submitted them for analysis repeatedly. Nobody has definitively explained what made them. The waveform keeps pulsing. Something in those mountains was talking, and it was talking back.
Mm-hmm. Talking back.
Talking back.
I love that.
The skeptics deserve their slide in the interest of fairness, in the interest of intellectual honesty, and in the interest of acknowledging that a smug scientist pointing at a chart is profoundly compelling aesthetic. Here they are, and they do have answers. The answers are just, as the slide text diplomatically notes, alleged. The most common skeptical explanation for Bigfoot sightings is misidentification, specifically bears. Black bears standing upright, and yes, a black bear standing upright at dusk at a distance of 200 yards in a dense forest is generally a visual experience that can produce alarm in a reasonable person. This is a legitimate point. It explains some sightings, probably a meaningful percentage of sightings. The bear hypothesis is not stupid, and the scientists pointing at the bear chart are not entirely wrong. The problem is that many of the witnesses are hunters and woods people who have encountered hundreds of bears and are not confused about what a bear looks like from any distance or any posture. When a retired wildlife biologist with 30 years of field experience in the Cascades reports something that was not a bear, the bear chart does not fully answer the question. The scientists know this, hence the PowerPoint crashing.
Mm-hmm.
Not crashing metaphorically. The skeptical case has real gaps. The hoaxes are accounted for, the bears are accounted for, the wishful thinking and misidentified stumps and attention seekers and confabulators are all accounted for. And when we remove all of them from the pile, there is still a pile, not a huge pile, but a pile. And a pile is sitting in the corner of the conference room when the PowerPoint crashes and none of the scientists in lab coats have successfully addressed it. They just reload the presentation and point to the bear chart again. So look at the forest, look at the density of it, that old growth Pacific Northwest wilderness photograph from the air, and what it communicates if you let it. It's scale. There are sections of that forest where no human has walked ever in recorded history. There are valleys in the Cascades and the Coast Range that have never been systemically surveyed. There are river drainages in Oregon interior that are accessible, if at all, only on foot after days of hiking, and only in summer when the snow recedes enough to move through the terrain. The Pacific Northwest alone contains roughly 70,000 square miles of habitat dense enough to conceal something very large indefinitely. Think about that, 70,000 square miles. And that shadow moving under the tree canopy I want to draw your attention to is not to manufacture drama, but because it illustrates the fundamental epistemology problem at the center of the entire conversation. The shadow is there. You can see it. Something is casting it. You cannot, from this altitude, from this angle, from this resolution, definitively say what it is. It might be a tree. It might be a bear. It might just be the afternoon sun cutting through the trees in a weird way. It might be something else entirely. The forest does not care which of those you believe. The forest keeps its counsel. What lives out there? What do you think, Daniel? Do you think that Bigfoot lives in the forest?
I think so. What's the evidence you said? It's something else. Whether there is a Bigfoot or a bear or whatever, just respect it. There's a territory between people and them, right?
Yeah.
Just respect it, because once you respect them, who cares if you're a human or something else?
It's true. Who cares? You're right. Care. If it's a Bigfoot or if it's a bear or something, you do. You have to respect it. I've seen a bear too, Daniel. I was at a park and a bear fell out of the woods. Can you believe it?
Really?
Onto the road. Uh-huh. Just fell out of the woods.
I think here in Canada, you are you have a license to kill a bear.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, they said, the meat of a bear is like a mutton.
You're it's like a what?
Mutton. A mutton.
Oh, mutton, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, I've had mutton. Goodness. I didn't like it too much, to be honest with you.
Have you tasted it already?
Yeah, I've tasted mutton. Not bear, but mutton.
Not bear. Just like, tastes like a mutton.
I've had buffalo, which was really good.
Uh-huh.
Bison. I've had ostrich. Pretty good.
Mm.
How about you?
I don't want to taste. I don't want to taste it, Mr. Bob. Either a mutton or a bear. I don't know.
Okay.
It's well, maybe
that'll be a whole other show. It'll be strange animal meals 101.
Yes.
Weird
tune
meat
in for that.
101.
tune in for that, people. For sure, Mr. Bob and I, we will enjoy that episode. Well, Mr. Bob, would you like to plug in something?
Oh, you can catch me here at the 101s, or you can catch me on Static Radio at staticradio.com.
Mm-hmm.
And keep an open mind, everybody. You never know what's out there. We don't know everything.
Yeah,
we can't know everything.
Certainly.
And so always be thinking, what could that be? Could it be real? Chances
or
are
not.
Probably.
Yes, that's why we are here. Conspiracy Theory 101, please. Please support us on Live 365, already live over there. We have a programming platform that will suit your listening. Yes. So, Mr. Bob, thank you so much for your time. What can people see you soon? What a Bigfoot.